Hey y'all, welcome back to We Rebel. Why, James is literally already laughing at me. We've been recording for approximately 5 seconds, so either it's not actually recording and this is a joke.
No. I take it very seriously here at We Rebel Studios.
And are you already laughing at me, though?
I think you're wonderful. I just want you to know that.
You know who's not wonderful? Nick, because he's not here.
Well, he's unfortunately on assignment in Antarctica working with the Tap Dancing Penguins.
Yep.
He'll report back to us next week. But for right now, you will deal with just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
But no, we're really excited. Guys, we have a wonderful interview.
Just the two.
We have a wonderful interview later with Sayu Bojwani. She's the founder and president of the New American Leaders Project. She'll talk with us in about a half hour or so. So if you want to skip ahead to that, go right ahead. Or you can listen to our lovely voices right now while we tell you a little bit about what's been going on the past week.
Yeah. I think we should jump in.
Yeah, so let's jump right in.
Let's jump into my least favorite topic so we can get into the other topics.
And we're going to just get it out of the way. So, with this Russia thing, it seems like every week we're learning little tiny details. So really what's happening...
Which I honestly think that's how it's going to be until, the investigation is done.
Well, that's the thing. It's all about finding the little clues because as we're going to talk about, it's really just we're interviewing people and it's getting closer. And our first article here, the dossier firm's lawyers accused David Nunes of unprofessional conduct. This is by Tierney Sneed for Talking Points memo. So essentially, they sent him a memo saying that, you're not doing a good job. The quote exactly is, now that you, and by extension your staff, have proven to be unreliable partners in good faith negotiations, we cannot reasonably be expected to trust anything that you or your staff would represent to us. We cannot in good conscience do anything but advise our clients to stand on their constitutional privileges, the attorney work product doctrine, and contractual obligations.
So I'm glad the law firm is upholding the Constitution. The next thing that happened, just going down our little checklist this week's details.
But also, what a passive, I don't know if it's passive aggressive, but it's the most polite way to say, hey, you're terrible at your job.
Yeah.
And we don't trust you. But anyways.
That's like what your boss says when they're like, you're not being professional. And you're like, so I'm late every day. Is that why you're pissed?
Carol.
And then that is why. Carol. Just Carol's kidding. Mad. If we have a Carol listener, I'm sure you're great at your job.
Oh, Carol, I'm a big fan of you.
Big fan of you. Well.
So the next article from Business Insider by Natasha Bertrand, a new memo suggests the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower meeting was acting as an agent of the Kremlin. Not a big shock. Obviously, we're talking about our longtime podcast favorite, Natalia Vetsenitskaya. The memo that she provided to the Trump campaign last year focused on that banker turned human rights activist Bill Browder, whose reputation has become inextricably linked to the global human rights campaign he launched in 2009 after tax lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Russian prison. So the document's language closely mirrored the contents of a memo provided to Republican U.S. Representative Dana Robacher by the Office of Russia's Chief Federal Prosecutor Yuri Shaika, while Rohrabacher was in Moscow last April. The similarities shed light on the music publicist Rob Goldstone, his original email to Trump Jr. pitching the meeting. And remember in that he said, quote, the Crown Prosecutor of Russia offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. So again, we're getting more similarities. We're getting a little more detail.
We're developing a thesis.
Yeah.
Well, we aren't, but the investigators are. So, good to stay abreast of these details. But unfortunately, as a citizen, there's not necessarily much we can do from where we're sitting aside from paying attention.
I will say it's now becoming less tinfoil hat and a little more like wax paper.
Sure.
We can sort of see what's going
There's
on now.
There's something... I don't want to say evidence per se, because that's like a scientific term. but it's becoming clearer.
Yes, it is.
Another article in Business Insider by our girl Natasha is titled Mueller has interviewed the cybersecurity expert who was described as, quote, being recruited to collude with the Russians. So essentially a cybersecurity researcher who was recruited to vet and hack Hillary Clinton's emails last year by a GOP operative tied to President Trump's campaign has been interviewed by the FBI special counsel Robert Mueller. That's this basically the title of the article and then the first sentence. But it's interesting. I mean, it's I enjoyed reading this article mainly because the world of like the dark net and like cybersecurity is not a world I live in unless I like happen to be watching a show where like that's the mode of attack.
Which Mr. Robot is great for that. And if you don't watch that show,
hop on board.
Start now. Like, in fact, this is the one time I say, stop the podcast, go watch Mr. Robot one episode and then come
and then
back
come
to
back.
Us. Come back to us.
Just pause it. Don't stop. Just pause.
I'll do a Mr. Robot podcast. I'll figure that out somehow.
Figure that out. Anyway, so it's an interesting article to read just because it's completely, I mean, it's French to me, the language. Actually, I speak French, so it's a different language to me. But it's really interesting. And then I think the last detail we want to touch on was reported in many locations, but we're referring to a political article by Annie Carney and Josh Dossi titled Spicer Interviewed by Mueller's Team. That happened on Monday. So, Spicer was interviewed. That's Monday, the 16th of October.
So Squinty Spice basically got interviewed by Mueller.
He did. And so there was an excellent NPR article that came out on Saturday that kind of pulls together some of these details that we've mentioned and others. And it emphasizes the importance of the November 1st hearing. So it's titled The Russia Investigations Interference Impacted Real Life. Senators Propose New Law. It was released on October 22nd by Philip Ewing. But for the time, I mean, there's always things to be paying attention to. Each a quote from this article reads, each passing week brings more such accounts as members of Congress, Justice Department investigators and tech companies look back at things they didn't know to view as suspicious at the time. So each story only adds to the frustration of Americans learning they were deceived, which is essentially, I mean, me, like everybody else, that's my frustration every week with it. So it's an interesting article. It hyperlinks to a couple different things for you to dig into. But in summary, it sounds like the next major hearing is on the 1st. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees will be hosting hearings, and legal representatives from Google, Twitter, and Facebook will be attending. So we might get some more hardcore information out of that, or we might not. So shall we move on?
Yeah. So let's go on to something that's
very sad.
And yeah, obviously,
and
the
disappointing, truly disappointing.
So obviously we lost 4 soldiers in Niger a few weeks ago. And, you know, the way it was all handled is it can be debated left and right, or left or right for this matter. Obviously, 4 men lost their lives. How it was addressed and the timeliness obviously was wrong. And the thing we're dealing with now, though, rather than talking about the way in which we informed our soldiers, the way in which we tried to extract them from danger, the way the intel that they got was faulty, you know, and so now what we're, instead of dealing with that, instead of dealing with how are we protecting our soldiers when they're out on the field protecting us, because they swore a duty to do that and we owe it to them to make sure that they're protected as well. Instead of that, what we're getting is the president mudslinging at a grieving widow and the family of the deceased. So in this article from The Hill by Rebecca Saravansky, the mother of fallen soldier, quote, Trump did disrespect my family. So the mother of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, who was killed in an ambush in Niger earlier this month, said President Trump did disrespect her family, despite Trump's insistence that remarks about a phone conversation he had with Johnson's widow were, quote, fabricated. So she says, President Trump did disrespect my son and my daughter, and also me and my husband. Johnson's mother, Kawanda Jones Johnson, told the Washington Post. Her comments came after Representative Frederica Wilson, Democrat from Florida, said Tuesday she overheard Trump tell Johnson's widow that the fallen soldier, quote, knew what he signed up for, but when it happens, it hurts anyway. This report comes after Trump spurred controversy earlier this week by claiming former President Obama and other past presidents didn't call the families of fallen soldiers. Here's my take on all of this. I can understand what he said, and I believe General Kelly, you know, he kind of defended Trump last week in saying like, oh, well, I told him to say this because this is what, you know, I went through when my child was killed in action. And I understand Trump's words, and maybe his tact is bad, But if you're worried about words getting misconstrued and you think you have a positive image and you're saying like, no, I'm doing better than all these other presidents. What he should have done was he should have attended that funeral yesterday. Now we're recording this on Sunday. The funeral happened on Saturday morning. Trump was golfing. He was not there. And if he was so, so pro-military and so about our soldiers and saying he's giving out all his condolences, he could have been there.
Yeah, this is a hard topic because the thing with grief is that there's no one way people process it. You know, so this widow and her family process grief in one way, which is obviously a completely different way than Donald Trump processes or does not process grief. Mm-hmm. But what is challenging here, I mean, again, Trump's words are true. He did know what he signed up for, but is that, that's not the moment to remind the widow of that. Mm-hmm. That's the moment to remind the widow of that when they're like laughing about something fun, the sun set in like 6 months from now. And maybe at that point it would be appropriate if it's in a loving manner. But what's challenging for me about this particular instance is that those words, and words matter, and his response by comparing himself to past presidents about what they did and did not do and did and did not call and et cetera, like, honestly, like, it's all important, but also none of that matters. Mm-hmm. Like, you as the current president, Donald Trump, need to focus on how you are speaking to military families. Mm-hmm. And if someone responds negatively, even if you don't think you were in the wrong, go correct yourself. Go call the widow again and say, I apologize. My first words didn't come off as loving and caring. You know, I understand people process in different ways. So I just wanted to reaffirm what I meant, which was that I'm sending, you know, love to your family and thankfulness for your son's service.
But this,
you know, the presidential thing is, even if this sentence was lovely and it was perfect and it wasn't, I knew what you signed up for, and the widow responded this way, the presidential move would be to call again. Mm-hmm. Or show up at the funeral, like you said.
Right.
Because in situations like this, whoever's grieving is who's right.
Right. And, you know, and I hate that they're doubling down. Like, you know, the fact that he sends Kelly out there to go defend his actions. You know, like, just accept some sort of fault. Say, okay, I was wrong. I handled this poorly. The best I can do is support your family in any way that I can.
And he gains nothing as far as respect or political acumen or whatever. He gains nothing by comparing how he treats these people versus past presidents, whether it's Obama or Bush or Reagan or whoever. Like, you don't gain anything from that because those presidents were doing the best they could do at that time to talk to military families or respond to incredibly uncomfortable and horrible and sad situations. And so it's like, you know, he doesn't gain anything from that. So it's a waste of time. So anyways, per usual, people, hopefully like us, who are trying to make a difference in the world and just lift people up instead of get caught up in this like cat fight around a funeral, which is completely the wrong space for it. I mean, I don't think there's space for cat fights anywhere, but if you're going to have a cat fight, can you not have it around someone's death? Mm-hmm. But anyways, so essentially almost overnight, Americans raised $200,000, for children of the grieving Army widow. So initially the GoFundMe page set a goal of $100,000, but overnight it had doubled that. And as of Wednesday morning, it's still going. The goal has now been up to $100 million.
And I think as of right now, I'm looking at now, they're at 687,943 of their 1 million.
Which is incredible. Yeah. And so again, like we try to do every episode is shine some light on a couple things that are just like people, no matter at what level or anywhere, anonymous or not, doing excellent work. And so this is really a testament of those that are trying to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Sticking on that, a little brief glimpse of positivity as we just
such talked, adorable yeah. positivity.
So our five living ex-presidents attended a hurricane relief concert. You want to talk about more?
I just think it's so cute. It was covered in all the news sources, but we pulled one from CNN titled Five Ex-Presidents Attend Hurricane Relief Concert. And as of Sunday afternoon, it was this huge concert and Lady Gaga was like the surprise guest at the end. She wasn't on the ticket. So everybody at Texas A&M got a Gaga surprise. And as of Sunday afternoon, so it happened on Saturday, so less than 24 hours later, the One American Appeal charity effort has raised nearly $33 million in tax-deductible private funds from more than 80,000 donors. And while the number of like $33 million is a lot of money, I think what's exciting to think about is that 80,000 people, mm-hmm. no matter what level, because everyone's in their own personal financial situation and we're all doing the best we can in theory. So what's really exciting is that many people were like, I've got $10, I've got $100, I've got $1,000 for this specific relief effort. So
And also, I just think it's beautiful to see Republicans, Democrats together uniting for a cause, saying, hey, like we can all get together and fix stuff.
Yeah. And I loved that too. And the only, the like twinge of like disappointment that that I felt, the only twinge I felt watching it was like, could you all could have worked a little bit together while you were all in office? But then I was like, oh, that's a fairy dreamland that we're not at yet.
Well, I feel like a lot of politicians, it's hindsight being 2020.
Always.
Because like when you're constituents.
Even though the rest of America is like, we see it. Like, can you all both just compromise a little bit?
And not like, the rest of America. But while you're there, it's like, no, I have my agenda. I want to get my stuff.
And I have my donors and whatever. Anyways, all that aside, truly, it's great. There's some really adorable videos of them talking and reacting to each other and shaking each other's hand. And then also, more importantly, so much money has come forward, which is really going to make a huge difference in these things. So
you know, I actually donated to One America Appeal last week. I don't know who follows me on Instagram.
You're one of the 80,000.
So here's what
James.
Happened. This is the second, maybe third time I've gotten an email from Trump headquarters. Have you gotten these yet?
No, I've never gotten an email from
DT. I don't know
DT.
How I ended up on this list, but God help me get me off of it. But they're literally.
You can unsubscribe. Did you unsubscribe?
Oh no! Because now I want to know what they're asking. Because
now you're like, am I your target market?
Here's what's interesting is that the email was about, oh, you haven't registered or entered your chance to win a dinner with the president. Donate $3 and you can enter your name in. I'm like, no, I'm not giving you money. Who needs money? Puerto Rico. Let me go help people that are experiencing disaster right now and need to rebuild
and
their lives. To have dinner with him? I don't know.
But like, where was the money going to go?
Probably in his back pocket. I don't know. I don't trust this administration. The fact that they're sending out emails about, oh, have a dinner with the president. It doesn't. And at least in the email that I saw, it had nothing to do with like, oh, where is this money going? It was $3 just to get in to this, I guess.
Because
drawing.
As someone who's done a lot of fundraising, that's not a half bad idea. It's like donate this small amount. Mm-hmm. You get entered into a raffle to like whatever. Insert exciting thing
but
here.
But
if you don't tell me where it's going, I don't care who I get to have dinner.
I mean, I'm sure I could have clicked the button and it would have said
but if it
something,
wasn't right there, that's right poor there. That's poor fundraising marketing, because that's why you want people to buy into the idea of what you're raising money for, not who you're having dinner with.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay.
All right, so now bringing it back down, unfortunately, let's talk about the travel ban a little bit. This is
the third travel ban,
third,
to be clear.
Yes. So this is a Washington Post article by Matt Zapatosky. A federal judge blocks Trump's third travel ban. So a federal judge on Tuesday largely blocked the Trump administration from implementing the latest version of president's controversial travel ban, setting up yet another huge legal showdown on the extent of the executive branch's powers when it comes to setting immigration policy. So the decision from U.S. District Judge Derek K. Watson in Hawaii is sure to be appealed, but for now, it means that the administration cannot restrict the entry of travelers from 6 of the 8 countries that officials said were unable to or unwilling to provide information that the United States wanted to vet the country's citizens. Watson wrote on the latest ban that the latest ban suffers from precisely the same maladies as its predecessor. Watson also wrote that the executive order, quote, plainly discriminates based on nationality in a way that is opposed to federal law and the founding principles of this nation. So then, another article from Washington Post with Matt Zapatosky. Second judge rules that latest travel ban, saying Trump's own words show it was aimed at Muslims. So U.S. District Judge Theodore D. Chuang issued a somewhat less complete halt on the ban than his counterpart in Hawaii did the day earlier, blocking the administration from enforcing the directive only on those who lacked a, quote, bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States, such as family members or some type of professional or other engagement in the United States. But in some ways, Chuang's ruling was more personally cutting to Trump, as he said the president's own words cast his latest attempt to impose a travel blockade as, quote, the inextricable reanimation of the twice enjoined Muslim ban. So, like,
I mean,
how many times is he going to throw this thing at the wall and hope it sticks? Because everyone keeps, it keeps bouncing back at him. Like, we know what you're doing. We know you're trying to ban Muslims. Yeah. That's incredibly racist. And also, we like, we've got a lot of, we've got stuff going on in here with white men. And he's constantly tweeting about, oh, there's attacks in London. There's attacks in France. There's attacks over here. We need to institute a travel ban. That has nothing to do with the other.
You're not understanding,
and you're not addressing
the
problems that are in this country right now.
Yep.
So like, stop trying to ban people from coming in here when you're not doing anything to help the problems within your own country.
Yeah.
Let's move on over here.
Let's move on
to healthcare.
So healthcare. So two senators strike a deal on health subsidies that Trump cut off. So this is a New York Times article by Thomas Kaplan and Robert Pear. So two leading senators hoping to stabilize teetering health insurance markets under the Affordable Care Act reached a bipartisan deal on Tuesday to fund critical subsidies to insurers that President Trump moved just days ago to cut off. So at the White House, virtually as the deal was being announced, President Trump voiced support for it while insisting that he would move forward to repeal President Barack Obama's signature health law. The plan by the senators Alexander, a Republican of Tennessee, and then Patty Murray, the Democrat of Washington, would fund the subsidies for 2 years, a step that would provide at least short-term certainty to insurers. These subsidies, called cost-sharing reductions, to go to insurance companies to offset their costs for helping low-income customers with out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures, such as deductibles and co-payments. Trump appeared to back it, even as he berated insurance companies, declaring the Affordable Care Act, quote, virtually dead, and promised the demise of the health law in due time.
Which I hate. Sorry, I just want to butt in. It's
fine.
It sucks to hear him want to something to die, just so that, just because it doesn't have his name on it, just because he didn't come up with it, just because it's Obama, really, right. A man who, by all means, is 10 times the leader that Trump could ever be. But he's so adamant about taking down his legacy.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly we just talked about this with the military families. It's like you're just comparing yourself to the last president is like a high school approach to leadership. Like, I get it. We're going to go back and forth as long as we have these two parties, et cetera, et cetera. But A, you don't have to. We can change that like habit and system. That's a super optimistic view, I realize, but still it's possible. And then B, again, I just don't understand what he thinks he's going to get. Even on the, I mean, sure, those on the far right will be like, great, let's take down Obama. But like all the smart Republicans I know are not voting Republican because they despise Barack Obama and want to take him down. Yes, of course there is that population and they're there. But, you know, I mean, it seems like a backwards, childish move.
And it's at our expense, because what's going to happen is, yes, you'll be able to get these insurance packages for, you know, catastrophic injuries or things like that. Your premiums are going to be lower, but you're going to have high deductibles. You're going to be paying a lot of stuff out of pocket, things that are routine. You're going to have to pay for yourself. So why are you trying to destabilize a market system for your people just because of petty grievance? Like, you know, yeah. It's like, don't hold us accountable for your ego.
Exactly. Basically. So this agreement that's in discussion bears the hallmark of bipartisanship. Yay. For Republicans, state governments would find it easier to obtain waivers for certain requirements of the Affordable Care Act, but there would be explicit protection for low-income people and people with serious illnesses. And I think that's really the crux of what we're talking about here when we have this healthcare conversation. Is there's the whole layer of the conversation, which we mentioned a few weeks back. Is it a citizen right? Can we get to that conversation? You know, Bernie's been talking about that for forever. But here, I mean, here is a viable give-get kind of situation that seems great. So that's truly the latest on healthcare. The article's in the New York Times if you want to read all the details. Mm-hmm.
But also call your senators anytime this healthcare thing comes up. Let them know. Like, get them.
Speaking of healthcare, I mean, this is totally a personal aside, but I have a dear friend who was diagnosed with systemic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 13. So everyone else entered puberty, and she entered the hospital for essentially 6 months. And so most recently, the past 5 years, she's had a really challenging time with her digestive tract because systemic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis sometimes attacks all your other body systems. So I've launched a GoFundMe campaign to help her with some of those crushing medical bills. So if anyone's listening is so inspired or has a family member that has gone through this, you know, any support would be wonderful. It's GoFundMe.com/Nicole Dalton. And also she's a fabulous comedian who's currently raising money this whole month for the, Creaky Joints organization, which is all about arthritis, early research development. So while she's fundraising for the cause, I'm fundraising for her with her, everybody in her system. So there's ways to engage, both, as James was saying, on a political level, but there's also ways to engage on a local level, like figure out what those prevented or what those pre-existing conditions are that are important to you, and look towards organizations that are doing research on finding a cure or providing resources for low-income people. But there's a lot of serious illnesses of which there is no cure. And it's kind of a double-edged sword there. So. Yeah. Speaking of double-edged swords,
yes. So let's
general fuckery.
Yes. All right. So real quick, we just want to touch on this article that came out earlier in the week. It's by Jane Meyer for The New Yorker, The Danger of President Pence. Really very interesting article. A lot to think about.
A lot to digest. Yes. But it's an interesting, it's definitely an interesting profile piece to spend some time with, because...
Sorry, I was just coughing out the demons.
Yeah, James had to take a minute, so I just stepped in and riffed. But it's a long piece, but it's truly helpful and interesting, and inspired me to kind of read other things that I didn't know about him. But
the thing I really want to highlight, and again, if you get a chance to read it, well, yes, he's also terrifying. But the thing I definitely want to talk about is that this exchange that Trump and Pence had. I'll read this paragraph. So Trump thinks Pence is great, Bannon told me. But according to a longtime associate, Trump also likes to let Pence know who's boss. A staff member from Trump's campaign recalls him mocking Pence's religiosity. I can't speak. He said that when people met with Trump after stopping by Pence's office, Trump would ask them, "Did Mike make you pray?" Two sources also recalled Trump needling Pence about his views on abortion and homosexuality. During a meeting with a legal scholar, Trump belittled Pence's determination to overturn Roe v. Wade. The legal scholar had said that if the Supreme Court did so, many states would likely legalize abortion on their own. "You see," Trump asked Pence, "you've wasted all this time and energy on it, and it's not going to end abortion anyway." When the conversation turned to gay rights, Trump motioned toward Pence and joked, "Don't ask that guy. He wants to hang them all."
So there's a lot to unpack there. But I think what's crazy is how he speaks. Like, this is his vice president. Mm-hmm. This is his VP. I mean, we all remember, you know, Biden and Obama and their adorable, like,
bromance.
And it's not always like that. And that's fine. And that was also, like, you know, egged on kind of thing. But, like, this is another example. We haven't talked about this in a few weeks, but another example of, like, the complete lack of leadership. You know, you want your White House, you want your cabinet and chief of staff who's in the cabinet and VP, you want people to actually be talking to each other like human beings and working together on something. And while I don't agree that we need to overturn Roe v. Wade, but just the way Trump treats him is insane. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, people always do those digs about things that people feel the strongest about. Yeah. You know, the digs usually come from some source of truth. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's crazy.
But excuse me, again, I'm exercising demons. That's scary.
It's scary.
It's scary to think that. Yeah, you have to remember, Pence still has these views, and these aren't just fabricated things. This isn't just tall tale or urban legend. You know, this is a real guy who, if he was in power, he might try to get some of these things pushed forward.
Yeah.
Definitely read this article if you get a chance to.
It goes pretty far back in his career, so it's interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think we're going to leave it at that right now. There's still more that we wanted to talk about, but you know what? We have a great interview coming up. So once again, Sayu Bojwani, she's going to be talking with us. She's the founder and president of the New American Leaders Project. So stick around for that. And
thanks for listening.
See you in a little bit.
Bye.
Bye. All right, everyone, welcome back to We Rebel. We are very excited Coming up right now, we have an interview with Sayu Bojwani, who is the founder and president of the New American Leaders Project. Please welcome her to the podcast. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Thanks so much for coming. We're excited to learn more about what you do and the organization that you founded. But I wanted to kind of start in reverse, or I suppose chronological order, and jump into a little bit about your personal background. So like many Americans, you're an immigrant yourself. And so I'm curious, you came here when you were 17 to study, and why did you want to stay? And what were those first few years like, and how did it evolve into what it's become?
Wow, that's a big question. Lots of questions. So why did I want to stay? To be honest, I'm not sure that I knew when I first came that I was going to stay. Also, like many immigrants, I came for college and then a graduate degree. And I think what kept me here and ultimately why I stayed initially and why I stayed long term is that, like no other country that I had ever lived in or been to, America provided opportunity. It wasn't always opportunity with a wide open door, but if you kept knocking, you generally could get somewhere. Maybe not as far as you wanted, but somewhere further than I thought I would be able to get in Belize, where I grew up. The range of options that were available to me professionally, the freedom that I had politically, socially, the experiences that I could have culturally, just were really unparalleled. And as much as it's been a bumpy journey, it's a journey that I'm always grateful for. And I think it's something that we take for granted, that immigrants are in some ways the most optimistic Americans, because we know what it takes to build a life here. Mm-hmm. And we've taken many steps to get to that point, you know, crossing walls, crossing borders, fighting prejudice, fighting bureaucracy. And so I'm really grateful to have that opportunity. And I think millions of immigrants feel the same way.
Yeah, and you definitely had to climb the ladder, because you did a TED Talk last year that is available to watch on your website, newamericanleaders.org. And, you know, you talk about your early stages in trying to enrich the lives of immigrants in terms in trying to run for office. You know, give us a little bit of background about that and how you got involved doing that.
Well, thank you for the plug of the website and the TED Talk. So when I first came, honestly, I came to the U.S. to study English and study education and be an English teacher. And then a number of years after I had been here and figured out that the job that made the most sense as my first job was in publishing, it took me a few years to understand that the system of integrating into the U.S., at least when it came to the workplace, was not as straightforward and as welcoming as I had thought as an outsider. And so what I think really was, like it is for many of us, there were a number of personal incidents that prompted me to really examine what was going on here and how that might be affecting the rest of my community, right? So I always say that that although I feel very fortunate to have navigated the system and to be, you know, relatively well-positioned, to have a lot of privilege that I have earned, but certainly is not available to everyone who works hard, right? Like, we have this mythology that that if you work hard, you can get somewhere, and that's not always the case. So I'm very aware that I have that privilege, and it's not a privilege that even many hardworking people have. And because I'm aware of that, and because I feel that my individual privilege is in some ways very meaningless unless everyone who looks like me, talks like me, is an immigrant woman of color, is a South Asian, is an Asian American, unless we all have the same access that I do, then my individual success is relatively meaningless. So that's a long way of saying that in the work that I've done, once I started to become aware of these barriers, all the work that I've done is really about trying to reduce those barriers, whether that's for South Asian youth, whether that's for immigrants in New York City when I worked for city government, or now for immigrants who might be interested in accessing the political process.
I'd love to hear more about the position you just mentioned in New York City. So you were the first commissioner on immigrant affairs. And I'm curious, was that a position that you were advocating for that became available? Did you apply? And then how were those first few years on the job? Because it was so timely also. I mean, it was right around the time of 9/11. There was a lot happening in the world. So I can't imagine that was easy. So what was it like?
Yeah. Well, being in government or public service is never easy, especially if you're trying to do the right thing. But also, I was brand new to politics, right? And also, I didn't really understand that I was in politics. I saw myself as being in public service.
Right.
And what happened really was that after September 11th, we had an election in New York City. And in that election, there was a referendum that the voters, through which the voters supported the permanent creation of an Office of Immigrant Affairs. So it was a change to the city charter that New York City voters voted for. And that's really how, so we had always had an Office of Immigrant Affairs, but it's the nature of its work varied depending on who the mayor was at the time and who was holding the position. And so after September 11th, once the office was established, as happens when you have a new mayor or governor, there was a transition committee, and the transition committee put forward my name. And I think that happened largely because while I was running a youth organization for South Asian kids, I thought it was really important that our needs and our voices were at the table, whether that was, for example, there would be citywide youth forums, and I or someone from my organization would be there, or there would be citywide immigration forums, and I or someone from my organization would be there. And what that, not realizing at the time when we were doing it, what I think that did, though, was put my name and my presence as a leader onto the radar of people in the city. And so I did get recommended, and then I did apply.
Right.
And so about 6 months after September 11th, I became the city's first commissioner of immigrant affairs. And, you know, as you correctly pointed out, it was a challenging time because we had a group of New Yorkers who, they were immigrants themselves. They had been affected by this attack on our city. They were grappling with that grief and that fear and that desire to do something. And at the same time, there were many, many immigrants who had those feelings as well as a feeling of fear about their own immigration status or a family member's or a friend's immigration status. And so the need to create a safe space was even greater than before.
And now, do you see that, so after that trying time of, you know, political climate, a lot of misguided fear towards people of color and religions that people didn't understand. And, you know, so how did you, in a way, do you felt like you helped change that narrative? Did you try to help calm those fears by like introducing like, hey, like we are people too. We are citizens. We are your neighbors. We are also running for office. So we want to help create a more cohesive community.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were so many different layers of work in that office that mm-hmm. included, and it was a two-way street, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it was about ensuring that the immigrant communities and immigrant leaders we were interacting with also kind of understood the way the city worked, because sometimes the fear was misguided on both sides, right? Mm-hmm. It was of immigrants and by immigrants. And so on the one hand, it was about kind of communicating city policies and practices to immigrant communities. And then the other side of it was, you know, communicating how immigrants were experiencing city government. And so, you know, you said, I would say definitely the fact that I myself embodied the experience was a incredibly significant thing. I think it was also, so it was a benefit, and I think in some ways it was also a challenge because it's very easy for people to dismiss something that you're saying as just your experience. Mm-hmm. In some ways, if a non-immigrant is speaking about immigrants, people privilege that narrative over a person who's actually talking about their experience. And so it was definitely challenging. And I think what was the most challenging for me was understanding that people in government had those fears and those concerns and were frankly irrational and not particularly open to understanding where these folks were coming from in that September 11th environment. Now, that's not obviously not everyone. It's just that I think I went in being somewhat naive about, oh, you're in government, you must understand. And I was quickly disavowed of the notion that just because you're in government, you're particularly qualified to serve the people.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that is a hard reality to realize. That was a kind of a double statement. But I actually remember when I was younger having that moment where I finally met someone at, like, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I finally met someone and they were like really mean to me. And I was so confused, this like young high schooler being like, but you work at City Hall, you should be like a good person and like wanting to change the world. And it was like a total slap in the face. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. That's here we go.
Sorry. Well, one thing I would add also that's really challenging, I think, is, you know, a lot of people make decisions, and a lot of government decisions are made based on resources. And resources, the way that resources are allocated in at the government level is not by virtue of your demographics, right? So it's not as if immigrant money is coming down from the federal government, right? It comes down as health money or education money. And so I think one of the challenges when you're doing this work in a structure that that really is supposed to serve all New Yorkers or all, you know, members of another city, is that you, when you're advocating on behalf of immigrants, people think it's an addition rather than a different way of thinking about how you're planning the way that your city is going to serve a community, you know? And that's always challenging because you're coming at it with a viewpoint and not with resources.
Right.
And yet, it's not about resources. It is about the viewpoint, you know?
Mm-hmm. And
does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Because, you know, as something that you, I loved, I'm going to go back to this TED Talk again. You said something that really stuck out to me, and you said the pale, male, stale leadership. Uh-huh. And it's all about, you know, perspective. And then when they're not taking the perspective of people that are different from them, that have had different backgrounds, that are, if they're not an immigrant themselves, they don't know the struggle that some of them have gone through. And so do you, before we go on to New American Leaders, I just want to ask, so in your time as commissioner, what do you think changed, and what did you see get better throughout your time in office?
So I think that my office had an impact on policy. I think that I can honestly say that I'm not sure that we changed people's viewpoints, but we did have policy in place. And so, you know, that's a decent enough place to start as far as I was concerned, mm-hmm. that we were creating, you know, we worked with the Department of Consumer Affairs to create protections for domestic workers. There was a lot of education, not just by my office, but by the Domestic Workers Coalition here in New York. And so I think it was a joint effort on the part of people on the city council, the mayor, my office, and advocates to make anything happen. And I'll just underline how important it is that all those four pieces worked together in many situations in order for anything to happen. And that was really how, you know, that was kind of my introduction to how politics works, that it's not about just your individual commitment. You have to really figure out how to move things with the help of all these different pieces.
Amazing. So you have your own narrative, like your own immigration story. You have your education here, you have, you know, this incredible experience in public office. And so I'm seeing how the connections are starting to be made. But, you know, what was the impetus to start New American Leaders Project? When were you like, oh, I can sew this all together and make a huge difference? And then, you know, in your own words, what is the American Leaders Project?
So, let me tell you when I first had the idea.
Okay.
Was 2008. But I didn't actually start it for 2 years. And I really first had the idea because we were in the middle of a presidential election, and a number of immigration leaders were trying to figure out how we were going to get comprehensive immigration reform in the first, you know, theoretically in the first Obama term. We didn't know that he was going to win. And the fact that we are here today without any immigration reform is sadly not a surprise to me. And when we were sitting there thinking about this, I thought, really, you know, we keep thinking about what do we do differently as advocates? What can we do differently to persuade Congress? And really, the problem was not us. The problem was not our, well, it was our strategy in the sense that we kept trying to convince the existing members of Congress what needed to happen. And so for me, it was about saying, you know, we need to change who we're talking to. And that's the long game. But in the short term, if we change who's in local and state legislatures, then at minimum, even though they cannot have an impact on immigration reform, at minimum, they can help address things like driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, like in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants, like creating more friendly police forces to build police and community relations. All of those things are really important things that city and state legislators can focus on. If you're on the school board, you can create a more welcoming environment for immigrant students. And so really that was my impetus, is I knew from having been a voice at the table that if we had more voices like mine at the table, they would be able to make local and state policy change. In 2010, what prompted me to finally do it, to take the leap to start an organization from scratch, which was no mean feat. I had done it once before, so I was really hesitant to do it again. But in 2010, Arizona passed SB 1070, which is this kind of infamous show me your papers law. And I could see how that was going to lead to more and more. And so that was really the final impetus for me to go ahead and jump in.
And so now, is this like a search looking for these people wanting to get involved in office? Like how are these people finding you, or how are you finding them?
So initially, the organization created partnerships with local organizations who we think are the ones that are best positioned to identify. You know, the idea is to not just pick people to run for office. The idea is to encourage people who we already see are making a difference in their community to take that leadership into a different arena, to be public servants, not just in community-based organizations, but also in government. And so in order to do that, we really need people at the local level to identify leaders. So we have a, you know, state-based model where we identify the states we want to work in and we identify partners. I would say that in the first few years, most of our alumni have come by, you know, through that route, through the partners. I would say increasingly, particularly this year, since the TED Talk, and also because of the political climate, and because we now have a robust alumni base, we're getting people from many different ways. So they're hearing about us on the radio or in the press. They are finding us because they're energized to run, or they're being recommended by an alum. Mm-hmm. And then they go through an application process.
And go ahead.
Sorry, just before when they get to the training, they have to go through an application process.
Mm-hmm. And now, are these people, like, so you said, they're already involved in their communities, you know, they're doing things on the ground that are catching your attention. Are you finding that they're similar stories? Like, are some of these people also immigrants that came here and realized that they could make a difference? You know, what are the types of people that you guys are engaging with?
Yes. So, I mean, to be honest, the average age of our applicants is 31. So many of them were brought here, frankly, at a very young age. I'd say probably the majority of the people we've trained came at a very young age. So didn't really have the same journey that I did. Now, obviously some people, it's, you know, we have over 500 alums, so there's a lot of stories, but But I haven't heard as much about people who've kind of gone through the same transition that I did. I feel it in some ways that I came more as an adult. Like I finished all my primary education elsewhere. I think the common themes are, you know, the immigration story of either themselves or someone in their family who has experienced the barriers that our system puts up. I think the common themes are also feeling like an outsider, you know, because of our religion, our names, our skin color. Many people we train are undocumented, so they're acutely aware of their immigration status. I think the other common theme is that despite all of the things that we encounter, there's a great deal of, and I talked about this earlier, a great deal of optimism about our ability to change how things work here for the better.
Amazing. And I'd love to hear, I think the state model makes a lot of sense because that can quickly ladder up and you can clearly develop this really strong group of 500 alum. That's incredible. But I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about what you mean when you say partners in different areas of the country. Are they national organizations or hyper-local? Do they focus on specific issues? Or how do you kind of build those relationships as well?
Sure. So mostly to date, most of our partners have been the local immigrant serving organizations or the state immigration coalition. So, you know, the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, in Michigan, it's APIA Vote Michigan, Access, which works with the Arab American community. In California, Southern California, we work with the Korean Resource Center and OCAPICA, you know, so it tends to be, I wouldn't say they're hyper-local, but they're definitely the city or state, the kind of primary organization working with either all immigrant communities or certain segments of the immigrant community.
That's great. And then do they come to you or do you seek them out as partners?
We seek them out, and we are, so the way that it works is that we generally now, I mean, the model has evolved a little bit because early on we were doing more trainings, and then we started to narrow our focus to a handful of states. We are specifically interested in working in states where we can get long-term funding commitments.
Yep.
Because we do see how really what we're doing is creating an ecosystem of a culture of running for office as a way to make change. And it's hard to do that if you're just swooping in and out of states. And so once we have the potential for funding or the actual funding, we identify a local partner who will be in Georgia. We just launched a Georgia program. We're working with New Georgia Project there. I'm worried that I've forgotten some partner names, so that's no good. and you know, the idea is they have to be willing to put in the time that it takes to recruit. It's the only thing we ask for them from them, but it's actually a very difficult thing to do, to encourage people to run for office. And it's gotten easier this year, but it's still hard to do.
Sure.
And do you find that there are certain states that it's harder for people of color to run? Are you finding more, like you had to pay more attention to certain areas to get this work done? I know this is a loaded question.
Honestly, I don't think so. Ah. I think that it's always hard to bring in political newcomers. I think that the biggest barriers is political gatekeeping. That's incumbents, that's party leaders on both sides, that's union leaders, I'm afraid to say. Anybody who is in power or connected to someone in power, which is quite a large universe of people in the political world, is very, very resistant to having a newcomer come in. And everybody we train pretty much is a newcomer, you know. Sure, there's some people who are staffers on elected officials, staffs. There are people who work for the different parties, for the state, etc. But, you know, as a candidate, they're a newcomer. They have not been anointed by anyone. And so I'd say it's an uphill battle just about everywhere, even in New York, which people think of as being so progressive. The truth is that New York City is a machine city, you know, and the unions and the Democratic Party and the Working Families Party really work together and the existing electeds to determine who they're going to anoint as a successor to an incumbent.
Now, I do want to ask about one thing, another thing from your TED Talk. You said this great thing, votes, voices, and vantage points. I just want you to expound on that a little bit for listeners who've not had a chance to listen to your TED Talk, but explain what those three things, the value of those three things.
Sure. So, you know, I talked and to a number of audiences, I try to break down why it matters that we're talking about immigrant communities, right? Like, it's very easy to say, well, why should we care? And one of the reasons that I think that we should care about immigrant participation is, frankly, that our democracy is stronger when everybody participates. That's not always the viewpoint that particularly incumbents have, because they are used to relying on a certain base of voters. And so what I mean by votes, voices, and vantage points is these are the three things that I think first and second generation Americans, or frankly, underrepresented Americans bring to the table. They bring their votes. Every single vote matters. And when you have new voters coming to the table, it can change the dynamic in an election. I mean, I tell a story in the TED Talk about someone who 1 year lost by 13 votes and ran again and won by 12 votes.
Wow.
And I have a number of stories of people who have won elections from between 44 and 78 votes. So when we talk about our votes not mattering, one vote doesn't matter. Actually, it really does. And that example of votes also is relevant to candidates who are not immigrants, right? So if you're choosing to take, I don't know how familiar your listeners would necessarily be with a walk list, for example, which usually the party and the campaign will generate. And that walk list tends to include people who have voted in the last few elections, right? It ignores people who have never voted before or who vote sporadically. And if you as a candidate, whether you're an immigrant or not, go and ask these people for their vote, you can really change the dynamic of an election, the outcome of an election. So that's where the votes matter. The voices matter in terms of what I was saying earlier, like having our voice at the table can change the way the conversation works. You know, there's a kind of classic saying that I believe is Ann Richards saying that if we're not at the table, we're going to be up on the menu.
Yep.
And I, borrowing from that, I say, you know, that we have to be at the table and we have to change the menu, because the way the conversation, when a conversation occurs about mass incarceration, when a conversation occurs about the curriculum that we're teaching in our schools, when a conversation occurs about which holidays we're going to give, you know, when you have voices at the table that have different experiences, and then this is where the vantage point comes in. Like, we bring a vantage point that is different, that fundamentally can change the conversation. And I'm ultimately an optimist, and I think that most people, if you are able to give them a perspective that they didn't have before, and you combine that with the power of your voice at the table, then you can actually change policy outcomes. You may not initially change hearts and minds, but if you could change the policy outcome, I can live with that, because we've been trying very hard to change the hearts and minds of the pale, male, stale, and we have not been able to do that. So I say, get a voice at the table, bring your vantage point, and then translate it into a vote that creates a policy outcome. And over time, people's hearts and minds might change.
I love that. I love everything you just said, but that phrase, we have to be at the table and change the menu, it resonates so much with me. And I'm sure with James, because that is honestly you know, why we started this podcast, that it's, you know, everybody has to do that all the time, you know, and it's not just, it's almost like being at the table is just the first layer and we're all trying to get there. And it's really important to focus on that. But the meat is changing the menu. Like that's when we get in the weeds of real, real change. And so it's so exciting to hear you say that and hear all about the New American Leaders Project. And so, you know, going off of that, what are some ways that people can engage with you, either if they're based in New York or throughout the country or online? How can people learn more about the organization and jump in?
Sure. So I just want to quickly mention before I answer that question directly that something that I haven't said yet about the way that we work, which picks up on this theme of changing the menu. So our organization's training has been designed for New Americans by New Americans. So it's not like we took campaign training and said, let's get a bunch of quote unquote diverse people in the room and tell them how campaigns are run. What we did is created a curriculum that says, we know that as New Americans, we're going to face certain barriers, but we're also bringing certain advantages. And so let's create a curriculum that addresses those barriers and addresses the advantages. So when we teach about your sort of targets, right, we talk about this universe of voters who are new and low propensity voters. When we talk about money, we talk about the reality that many of us are bringing some concerns about asking for money to the table. And so let's talk about that. Let's talk about why it's important that we ask our communities to invest in our campaigns. We talk about how do we tell our story as part of the American narrative. That it is an immigrant story and it is a specific story, but it is a story that is part of the larger America. And so we can't just deny aspects of who we are if we're going to run as the kind of candidates that the New American Leaders Project wants to see. So here are some things that you can do. Not everyone's going to run for office. We understand that. Not everyone should run for office also. I think that there are a number of ways that people can get involved. One is show up to your school board and your city council and your state ledge meetings. Let them know that you are paying attention to what they're doing. I don't think very many people go to those meetings. Frankly, they're not that interesting. But these guys, and they're often guys, are making decisions about your school budget, about your school superintendent, about zoning requirements in your neighborhood without anyone paying attention because it's not interesting. And so go take a friend, take five friends, pay attention to what's going on. That's one thing. I think the second thing is to also think about who you can invite to run for office. If you're not going to run yourself and you know somebody's been there for 25 years and year after year there's no opponent, or they've been there for 5 years and they get no opponents but they're not doing their job, then help someone run against them. Obviously, you can go to newamericanleaders.org and sign up for our mailing list, learn about our training so that you or someone else can take them. We also are in the process of launching a number of digital campaigns that you would be able to engage in. I think over time, we want to really not just have lots of people in office, but have all of those people, even the people we are helping elect, know that we're paying attention to what they're doing. We're holding them accountable. And so those are some things. We are a nonprofit C3 organization, so we always welcome support. And I can't encourage you to support individual candidates who have come out of our program. But if you can do the math and figure it out, then we do encourage you to support new people as well. Go out and help them register voters. I think that if there's one thing we learned from this election is that, you know, we can't not pay attention. We can't just assume it's all going to be okay.
Absolutely. And with 500 alumni, you said over 500, you know, there's definitely a lot of people to look into and support. And so, like Sayu said, please go to newamericanleaders.org. You can donate. You can get involved in their future campaigns. Go to your meetings. Invite your friends. Talk about the people that are exciting you and your community, and get some new voices out there. We need to be at that table, everyone.
And change the menu.
Change that menu.
Change the menu.
It's definitely time. Thank you so much for talking with us. This has really been enlightening and inspiring. Like the fact that you have so much optimism in a time of a lot of strife. It's really amazing to have someone saying like, you know what, we're still going to go to work and we're still going to get the job done. And thank you for inspiring so many to do that.
Great. So yes. You can find
thank
us.
You.
Of course. So you can find us, We Were Bell Podcasts, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and then on whatsacreative.com and Apple Podcasts.
Yep. And so we'll see you all
next week.
Next week. Bye.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?